I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. A new study from Americans for the Arts claims that each year in America, the nonprofit arts and culture industry generates $166 billion in economic activity. Our guests today are leading efforts to make sure their cities get a big piece of that action. We'll talk to Vincent Kitch about Austin's strategies to promote film and music, Ginger White about Denver's programs to support art and space for artists, and Jair Lynch in Washington about his attempts to develop artist housing. Plus, we'll find out how arts organizations are finding new audiences from Sorrell Phillips. That's all today on Smart City, but first, this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Vincent Kitch is Cultural Arts Program Manager for the City of Austin. Ginger White is Senior Economic Development Specialist for the City of Denver's Office of Cultural Affairs. They shared a panel at this year's National Meeting of Americans for the Arts called Economic Development and the Arts, How Large Cities Get Creative. I interviewed them just before their panel began.
You're both speaking at the Americans for the Arts conference here in Las Vegas. First of all, does Las Vegas seem an odd place to have an arts conference?
I don't think so. I mean, this is sort of the epitome of commercial art, the synergy of arts and commercialism, and it's an exciting town.
Ginger, how about you?
Well, I think at first glance it does seem rather odd, but I agree with what Vincent just said, that it really is the epicenter for all things commercial and incorporating the arts as part of it. So I think it is kind of a unique, almost a dichotomy, but or oxymoron maybe is a better word.
In your cities, Austin and Denver, both very successful cities, do you consider arts as part of the entertainment box or the economic development box? Where does arts fit into the city's strategy?
Well, absolutely, in all of that. In Austin, we look at arts and culture both from the nonprofit sector as well as commercial film and music, which are very important. But all of these industries represent about $2.2 billion of our local economy as well. And so it's part of all of that, and quality of life and everything that contributes to what Austin is.
And in Denver?
Well, I think traditionally we've looked at more of the nonprofit model and have seen it more as a quality of life and that sort of thing. And we're sort of shifting now to look at it as an economic development tool as well as a lever for future economic development as far as business attraction and relocation and that sort of thing. I think the interesting thing that we've also done is looked at we're starting to look more like Austin, look at the commercial side of the arts. And that is sort of a new shift for our office, definitely.
When you say the commercial side of the arts in Denver, what does that mean?
We define that as art galleries, art districts, music and film. So sort of the for-profit side of the arts.
And do you make any distinction between the two?
We try to. And now we're really looking at it as a full ecosystem. And that's sort of what I do. Originally, my position was really to look strictly at the commercial arts. But so many things and so many policies bleed over that it's sort of it's an artificial, I think, delineation that we've sort of are getting away from.
This is an argument that some have made very forcefully, that we should blur that line completely between the for-profit and not-for-profit arts. I know, Vincent, that the commercial arts in Austin really contribute a lot to the vibe of the city, as you've said, the economy of the city. How do you support the nonprofit arts versus the for-profit arts?
Well, no, I think we do a lot of initiatives. We have the very traditional sort of funding for local arts nonprofits that government or arts councils do, and I think that's a very important part of keeping that ecosystem alive. Government funding is absolutely essential in the nonprofit model to many of these groups. And we have a lot of very small nonprofit organizations, and so we do sort of traditional funding in that way. And then we also, on the commercial side, work on the city side to develop policies and ordinances that make it, you know, easier to film and cheaper to film in Austin, or things that will affect the live music industry. And they do really cross over, because a lot of course of our theater, people that work in the nonprofit theater by day and night, are also people that work in the film industry, and the musicians cross over constantly. And so those industries are very much tied to each other, and there's a lot of crossover, but I don't know that we should completely blur those lines, because there are very specific needs that nonprofits face in the work that they do versus the sort of for-profit commercial industry, and government has limitations in how they can support each of those.
What is the most exciting thing happening today in Austin in terms of the arts scene there?
Wow. It would be very difficult, I think, to pick one. I mean, our film industry is really booming and growing and continues to be popular. We're doing a lot of work on the city side and working with private developers as they are working in the city. And we've really transitioned what I believe is the traditional Percent for Art program to now a lot of private developers are coming on board and voluntarily producing public art projects. And they're working with the city on that. The city is also done some development deals where they encourage developers to partner with cultural institutions and contribute to our arts and culture landscape. And I think that's the future and the key direction we're moving.
And Ginger, what about in Denver, the most exciting thing happening today?
You know, we've had such so many cultural milestones over the last year, the opening of the new wing of the Denver Art Museum. We have a new contemporary art museum that's coming online. Clifford Still Museum is upcoming. So there's a lot of really kind of big boom projects, big bang projects that are happening in Denver. I think, though, the most exciting thing from where I sit is sort of what Vincent touched on, which is there seems to be a policy and seed change that's happening in Denver, understanding that arts and culture is not just our large and even small nonprofit organizations, but the ecosystem is much broader. And so people are beginning to think about that, I think, a little bit more thoughtfully about what are those policies that are going to be helpful to the commercial, such as film and music, and then also thinking about the development sector and developers thinking about ways in which to incorporate arts and culture in a way that's sustainable and meaningful to the cultural community.
Yeah, and we're in the middle of doing a comprehensive arts plan, a cultural planning process. And, you know, it's interesting because people always ask me, what are the key issues that are really arising out of these discussions when you do all these community meetings? And it's not really facilities. And, of course, we hear about facilities and funding, but it's transportation and affordable housing and healthcare. And so even the arts community is really looking at much broader issues, I think, than what we've traditionally thought they were concerned with.
Ginger, I want to ask you about Mayor Hickenlooper's feelings about the Big Bang projects, as you call them. Is there any sense at all that you may be overbuilding? Does he sense that there is an unlimited market and unlimited support base for these kinds of facilities?
You know, the mayor has been so strongly behind arts and cultures. It was part of his campaign. He really calls Denver the creative capital of the Rocky Mountain West. And so all of these projects really feed into that for him. I think the draw is that, and the idea is that hopefully this is going to be attractive not only to residents, but also for tourism. And certainly we've seen that over the past year, tourism has increased and interest in arts and cultural tourism has increased as well. And so hopefully the market is not just within our residents, but it's going to expand and include national and international visitors.
You both work in what today are strong markets. If you each move to a weak market or a market where the real estate is not strong, where the economy is not strong, how would you take what you've learned in these strong markets and adapt that to a weak market? Where would arts fit into that weak market and its economic development strategy? How do you think the arts could be used most effectively in markets weaker than Denver and Austin? Vincent?
And that certainly is something that it makes it a little easier, I guess, with Austin being so creative and so attractive. But I've worked in Michigan and other areas of the country, and I think you have to really focus on what the cultural assets are of the community first. You can't artificially recreate Austin in a place that isn't Austin. And so you have to identify what the cultural assets are in the area, and then you utilize the artists and the creative industries to promote and highlight those enhancements. And I've seen very small towns in Michigan where they started doing subsidized artist housing, a live workspace, and sort of created a draw for artists to come live and work in their community, and that then reinvented their downtown, which was 20 years, you know, dead. And so there are many ways that artists can contribute to any type of community, but you really have to identify what the strengths are in that area, I think, first.
You know, I think rural communities and those smaller cities are actually somewhat more innovative when it comes to how they incorporate arts and culture as part of an economic development strategy. I think there's a tendency to be a little complacent in larger markets, or the arts are still kind of the small fish and we're going to go for the big dog that's going to, going to be here and it's never going to change, you know, whether it's a corporation or something to that effect. So I've always been really impressed by rural and smaller communities of how they're so innovative with using the arts and culture as an asset.
In a perfect world, what would you like to see next, Vincent, happen in Austin and on the arts and culture scene? If you could just wave your wand, what would it be?
Wow, so many things. I would like to see our film studios completely renovated and updated so that we really have the capability in both production and post-production that Hollywood really wants us to have, because I think we have a great labor market and we're a very popular destination, but we could do a lot more just in infrastructure in that. We need facility enhancements, and we do have the Long Center for the Performing Arts coming online, but we need alternative venues and facility spaces as well as affordable live-work space for artists. And Austin, we need to really develop as well a stronger philanthropic base related to art, not just in nonprofits in general, but arts and culture specific, that it's not as strong as I think a lot of people would think that the support for the arts would be in our city.
That's generally true of most new money cities. And we heard the same thing in Silicon Valley recently. We heard the same thing in Portland, that there's a lot of do-it-yourself culture, but it's very hard to find foundation money or even corporate money for these kinds of investments. How are you thinking about that, Vincent, in Austin? How are you thinking about developing that support base?
Well, again, we're in the middle of doing our comprehensive arts plan called Create Austin, and there's a web presence for that. But there's actually a group of people working on what's called the Campaign for Philanthropy, and they're trying to develop an actual sort of live here, give here campaign to really get Austin more engaged in giving to nonprofits in general. And there are several nonprofits and myself that are involved in that, trying to make sure arts and culture are tied into that campaign as well.
And Ginger, is that a problem in Denver?
Very much so. I mean, we're not a city of many Fortune 5s and that sort of thing. We're definitely a community that's based on small companies, much like small businesses, much like Portland, and a lot of entrepreneurs as well. And so part of it is trying to educate the arts community to think a little bit more like an entrepreneur or a small business might. And they're pretty good at doing that already. But then at the same time, we expect that a lot from our small arts organizations, but we don't provide them the same kind of tools that we provide our small business or entrepreneurial community. And so one of the things that the City of Denver has done is created a revolving loan fund, somewhat similar to what Austin has done for the music industry, to try to encourage that kind of innovative thinking, but also have money tied to that, which is not always something that has been done in the past.
Vincent Kitch is Cultural Arts Program Manager for the City of Austin. Ginger White is Senior Economic Development Specialist for the City of Denver's Office of Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Also at the Americans for the Arts meeting in Las Vegas, I met Sorrell Phillips, who works with arts organizations to develop new audiences. She heads Decision Support Partners in Bozeman, Montana. Sorrell, what does your company do?
I do cultural research for individual arts organizations and for communities all over the country.
What does cultural research mean?
It means learning about our arts audiences and our audiences for cultural participation and how we as organizations fit into our communities. I've been working on these community projects recently in communities like Orlando and Milwaukee, and recently Memphis, in which we're bringing together lots of different cultural partners, 20 to 60 different organizations coming together to study their audiences and their marketplaces so that they can find the opportunity for growth in their markets.
And where can they find opportunities for growth? That's an issue that is on the minds of many arts organizations today, cultural organizations. So how are you helping them find growth?
Well, one thing that we're doing is just the process of bringing people together and having them understand that by studying their collective audience and looking at that in relation to their own audience, it dispels this myth that they're all competing with one another for the same audience. So understanding, helping them to understand their patrons better, understanding how their market looks and how the art sector fits within that, we're able to work as a community, like you take the community of Memphis or Milwaukee, you can segment that market and say, here is the geography where the arts need to dominate. This is the mainstay, the core market of arts patronage in this particular town. And then there might be an area of the geography that's typically overlooked by arts marketers. And I consider that an area for investment, where our lens and trying to find audiences is typically so narrow because we have these assumptions about who our patrons are. So bringing people together, having them share information and really take a look at who their customers are, makes a lot of these myths go away. And I think that's where the opportunity is.
And when you look at a city, let's take Memphis, where you're working, where is the arts audience? Where's the cultural audience? And how can you generalize about that audience?
Well, the first thing is that the arts audience in Memphis is a lot more diverse than the arts organizations thought. That was one myth that was dispelled. Because you come into a community, and typically people think that it's all the same people going to everything. You're able to show, doing research like this, that collectively that's just really not the case at all. So there's opportunity in certain neighborhoods and growth areas inside the city and outside of the city. There are, I'm able to look at the context of where audiences are and where populations are growing with similar characteristics to people who participate in the arts by their lifestyles. And then we're able to look at areas of the region and the city where they can work through their education partners with their other community partners for the long term to build audiences for the future.
Is there anything you can tell us about the general characteristics of the arts audience?
You know, I'm not gonna say that there is a typical arts audience. I think that I'm learning through this kind of research that's often combined with surveying, where we're asking people to share personal stories about how they were transformed by the arts. There is not a typical arts patron.
And yet you're trying to look at the existing arts patrons and cultural patrons, and even in Memphis, sports patrons, and generalize. You're trying to say, here's what that market looks like, and then let's go find people like them to increase the audience. So people like them, who are they?
People like them are more diverse than we thought. They run the gamut from, you know, highly affluent, highly educated, to middle income, lower income, and geographically dispersed. Now, you find more of them by understanding what it is that's relevant about your programming and your artistic vision that resonates with people. What's relevant about your theater company or your dance company or your museum programming? And that's not necessarily a characteristic such as, you know, because they have a high income level, they're more likely to find our programs relevant. So when you study the way people participate and what they participate in, you're able to craft your programming and your messaging to fit into people's lives a bit more effectively.
As an arts marketer, typically my funds are limited, my time is limited, and my ability to reach segmented audiences is limited. So how do I take this notion of, well, it's different than you think, it's more diverse than you think, it's actually much broader than you think, and with my limited budget, my limited time, my limited ability to get to diverse or segmented audiences with segmented messages,
right.
And now you're challenging me also to do segmented programming.
Yeah. In some cases, what's happening is there are individual solutions that an organization itself can take. And people are doing things like just reallocating the resources and saying, wow, this is really the market that is the strongest, the shortest, the lowest hanging fruit for me. I need to speak with these people directly and more personally. So I'm going to take some of maybe my mass media dollars and put it into direct communications. But I'm not going to ignore this other sector that might be a future market for me that I just don't know about, but this research is telling me, wow, these people are inclined to participate in the arts. And I might do a couponing offer there. So it's not about just spending more and more and more money on cultivating audiences. It's about reallocating resources a little more effectively. So individual solutions, but there are also collective strategies that by working together, these different communities are finding, you know what, it makes more sense for us to work together on a cultural calendar or a web portal. In Kansas City, the groups, the performing arts organizations there had a history of working together, and they looked at their joint pool of resources that they did together. They did one thing annually every year as a performing arts sector, and they took those dollars and they reinvested them in an electronic communication, sort of opt-in arts alert thing that goes out every week. And they're spending essentially the same amount of money, and they're having yearly exposure.
Are you finding that busy consumers are willing to get in their inboxes information about arts activities, for instance, that they don't know they're interested in? In other words, if I'm interested in the ballet, I don't perceive myself as ever going to the opera, and probably won't. Having done it in the past, don't want to do that. So if I get information about the opera, is that simply taking time away from what I could be understanding about the ballet, which is something I do want to attend?
Carol, what we're trying to get at through some of this research is somebody like you, not just understanding your interest in ballet, but what is the experience like that you enjoy? So are you interested in ballet because of, for instance, new choreography, new work? Is that what inspires you? Well, if you're interested in cutting edge or new programming, other organizations that are doing that kind of work might also be of interest to you. So we're not saying bombard your household with all of these different messages. We're saying understand what you find personally rewarding about your arts participation. And understanding that, maybe offering you other things that fit within that would be useful or welcome. And we're finding that people are interested in receiving information if the organization sending it to them show that they care enough to learn about the consumer and their interests.
If you look at the work you've done in Orlando, Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Memphis now, what insights do you think that work has produced that groups have acted on that you think has been most effective in terms of building new audiences for arts, culture, and sports?
I think the work that I've done that's been most effective has been the work that has led to collective solutions to problems. For instance, what Margot Knight is doing in Orlando, Florida. Well, it's Central Florida, actually, with a project called the Red Chair Project. I think that was a really long-term investment in serving cultural patrons and providing easy access to information and events. It's a special place for arts patrons to donate, to get information, to have access to tickets. And it's like one-stop shopping for arts and cultural participation. It's way beyond just a cultural calendar. But for instance, some communities don't really have those. And if they do, they might be limited to arts with a capital A versus entertainment with a capital E. And in some consumers' minds, those things aren't necessarily separated. You might have a personal interest in repertory theater, but to you might consider it a form of entertainment. So when you're thinking in your mind, what are we going to do on this Friday night? If you go to a cultural website, quote unquote, you're going to get certain options, and if you go to an entertainment website, you're going to get different ones. So we're looking at blending those things in some places so that from the consumer's perspective, the decision-making is a lot easier and encompasses the arts more fully.
I want to change subjects and ask you why you live in Bozeman, Montana.
Well, I live in Bozeman, Montana because I moved there just over 10 years ago with a company who I worked for called Arts Market, and I had planned to stay there maybe a couple of years, and I fell in love and got married. And I have been there ever since, and I'll be celebrating my 10th anniversary.
What is it about Bozeman that you find compelling, other than the work and other than the husband?
Bozeman is one of those places where the quality of life is really good. It's a little bit slower. That's appealing to me. It's a little bit slower pace. It's physically very beautiful. And in this virtual world, you can really live anywhere. If you're doing the kind of work I'm doing, you can do the research stuff behind the scenes, and then I get to travel all over the country and work in these wonderful communities face-to-face. So I think I have the best of both worlds.
Sorrell Phillips heads Decision Support Partners in Bozeman, Montana. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta.
The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Plan Edison assistant editor Nate Berg.
TOD stands for Transit-Oriented Development, a modern take on a traditional urban development model near and around transit stations and routes that encourages transit use and walking by creating higher density housing and a mix of uses. TOD has been gaining increasing popularity in cities across the U.S., but now in more than a dozen cities across the country, a new take on TOD is developing, TOD without the T. USA Today reports on cities that are building dense, walkable, mixed-use neighborhoods in areas where transit has not yet developed, and in areas where transit's not even in the works. Cities such as Fairfax, Virginia, and Scottsdale, Arizona, are among the non-transit-oriented communities creating TOD. Some are calling these transit-ready developments, built in the hopes of luring transit systems. And though many would welcome transit, many cities have built this transitless transit-oriented development to simply embrace the compact and walkable urban design. And while these developments could provide a boost to the prospect of developing transit systems, transit in Vancouver was recently dealt a blow when a city report revealed that the city's expensive dedicated bus lanes, a strategy widely perceived to increase the efficiency of public transportation, had not lived up to their intended goal of reducing travel times. The Vancouver Sun reports that the city's Strategic Transportation Planning Department looked at current travel times in the bus-only lanes and compared those travel times to older times from before the dedicated lanes were built. The difference is less than the error of margin in the study, showing that the dedicated lanes do nothing to reduce travel times. Though dedicated lanes have shown success in other cities, if the same results are found in a similar study on another bus line, Vancouver may decide against bus-only lanes in the future. And finally, in California, the state's long-held dreams of building a high-speed rail system seems to have hit one very powerful speed bump: the governor. San Diego City Beat reports that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has repeatedly delayed statewide voting on the $10 billion bond issue that would fund development of a high-speed rail system connecting major cities such as San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, and San Diego. He is now requesting another delay of the bond issue, currently set to be included in the 2008 ballot. The governor's office said this delay is in the best interest of the state, allowing other bonds to be passed off for such projects as road improvements and highway repairs. The political punt may not be a good sign, but for proponents of the high-speed rail system who have been pushing it for more than 10 years, another delay comes as no surprise. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Plan Edison. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jair Lynch was also on the panel with Vincent and Ginger. He heads Jair Lynch Companies, a development firm in Washington, D.C. We shared a panel recently at the Americans for the Arts meeting. What was a real estate developer doing on an arts panel?
Well, it's been important for us to be able to think about how cities have come together over time and what's successful in urban places. And for us, we started to recognize that there were some synergies between the arts community, between institutions and other assets that are in a neighborhood, and when we try to honor the soul of the place. And we feel that if you are helping a city move forward and to mature, that you have to honor the existing assets, and many times it's artists, it's churches, it's the fabric of the community, and we want to make sure that we can make sure that that's bolstered over time. And so being part of an arts panel like that is important for us, because we see them as vital parts of the overall ecosystem of neighborhoods.
You've used several terms I want to explore with you. First, you talked about honoring the assets and bolstering them over time. How do you honor the assets?
Well, one of the things we do when we start working in a neighborhood is go and listen, Because I think when you start by listening to the stories of a neighborhood, you can recognize the physical, the human, the social assets that are there. One story is you may purchase a site and recognize from the little old lady who lives around the corner that one many years ago there was a stream running under that site. And that tips off how we're able to design and make sure that we can either incorporate the stream and provide a sustainable bioretention pond or something along those lines. Or if it's a church that may be able to give us historical pictures of what was on a site in years past, or even the people that can talk about some of the struggles that may have gone on in that neighborhood over time. And being able to honor that history, that authenticity, and hopefully get back to sustainable neighborhoods is important for us. And we think that there's a big cry for that. There's a big cry in the marketplace for people to be in authentic places in which they're not cookie-cutter little boxes, but actually places in which people can be in tune with, as I said before, the fabric of the community.
Do you really see the value? Do you get the value out of that? If you indeed honor the soul of a place, if you honor the history of a place, are you able to realize that in real estate value?
Well, it helps in many ways. If I put my business hat on, I can say that honoring the soul of the place and being in touch with people mitigates risk for us. Because one of the biggest things and impediments for doing projects in urban markets is getting through entitlements or other things that may happen there, or permitting or other aspects, and getting the community involved and listening to their stories and incorporating them into the project allows us to mitigate risk and get projects done faster.
That makes sense. When you say listen to the stories of a neighborhood, explain how you do that.
I spend a lot of times on the couches of many older women, the moms and pops, and the so-called mayors of the neighborhoods that we go and listen to and understand what are the concerns. The other thing that's important for us is that you often hear about institutions that are needed in the neighborhoods, whether they're medical clinics or libraries or recreation centers or other institutional buildings that are important. Important icons in the neighborhood, we have set up our business that allows us to not only make investments in neighborhoods, but also assist in the other public-private partnerships that are needed to bring those assets to the neighborhood as well.
And do you do that by negotiating with government? I mean, you're building in places that government wants you to build, and therefore you can negotiate for those assets, or does it take place in some other negotiation?
No, we definitely negotiate with the municipality, and most of our work is in Washington, D.C., and we see it. Sometimes it's the reverse, where the city wants to make an investment in the community, and they'll do it with an institutional building like a recreation center to make a statement that something could happen there, and then we may come behind and buy and invest and develop either affordable housing or mixed-income housing near those assets. Or it could be the reverse, where we have the vision and buy a piece of property and want to bring in those assets to bolster our project. So it happens in a symbiotic relationship with the municipality to recognize what are the needs of the community.
I want to explore for a minute your notion of a rec center. It seems to me that who occupies the public realm or public facilities says a lot about the state of the neighborhood. And I know that you work in a lot of transitioning neighborhoods that are where value is increasing, where you're providing, let's say, a better, higher quality and more expensive product to the neighborhood, expecting to get, in effect, a different sort of person in your projects. And I'm wondering, thinking about, for instance, a rec center and who that may attract. And does it attract rowdy kids, or let's say you do a senior center, and then the seniors become very visible, and to some extent that labels or brands a neighborhood. I'm just curious how you align your interest in branding a neighborhood and moving it forward, if you will, in terms of value, and the public facilities that you negotiate for or hope to get, and how they are populated or used.
Well, we think that that buildings, especially public buildings, need to evolve over time. And so what we do is make sure that there's room in the facility for the seniors during the day and for the teens at night and for the young mothers at yet another time on the weekend. And allowing for flexible spaces in this public realm, both indoor and outdoor, hopefully brings together the mixture of people that we the diversity that we think is necessary to make a great community. And that diversity is not just race and class, but it's age and it's different ideas, and bringing those things to those public spaces and public buildings is very important for us. The one piece that we don't do that we would love to do in the future is help with the programming so that the programming can enhance this mixture as well and enhance and expand everyone's worldview.
Have you ever found that the programming becomes a problem, that it's too one note and doesn't reflect the diversity that you were hoping for, and therefore again brands the neighborhood as one thing when you're trying to move it to something, let's say, more diverse?
Well, what we do is much of our work is as a result of our civic responsibility, and we think that that is very important. So our staff is often on the boards of, let's say, nonprofits or advisory committees for these public spaces in the neighborhoods that we work with long after we are completed with the projects or working on others in the neighborhood, because that we think that that's very important to be able to have a voice from the time we started the project or the time that we started working in a neighborhood, have that voice continue and that story continue about what the vision can be for the neighborhood.
Diversity is not always easy to make work. We've had a history of not only single-use neighborhoods, but single-income neighborhoods, single-age neighborhoods, and you're trying to make something that is potentially much more interesting, but obviously much more complex. Are there tricks you use to make diversity work, or are you simply putting it out there and letting the people who want that and respond to that respond?
Well, I think it starts from an internal assessment of great places around the world. And we just had a tragedy here in Washington, D.C., in which Eastern Market in Capitol Hill, the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Washington, D.C., just caught on fire. And the day after Eastern Market burned down, people came out and were crying. And it was an emotional attachment to a place that did exactly what we are talking about. It was an open-air market with arts and crafts. It was a market where you could buy fish, you could buy sweets, you could buy art. And the people that came to Eastern Market ranged from the school teacher in the neighborhood to the congressperson who may be from another state. And I look around at places like Eastern Market, like Pike's Place Market in Seattle, and many other places around the world. And those are usually in, like you said, in civic and public realms. And we say, how can we expand that mixture into how people live, how people work, and how people learn? And I think that there's a natural affinity towards these places that is buried in our subconscious, because we go there for one activity, but yet not for another, until the opportunity is brought forth and the connection can be made that I could live near an Eastern Market or I can work near an Eastern Market and go there and enjoy that time during the day at lunch or on the weekend or in the evening on a stroll. And through that, we think that we are reconnecting the bonds of people, where we can move away from being just consumers of goods, but actually take a civic stance in our neighborhoods and our communities.
You say that you offer tools that help people help you in creating place. What are those tools?
Well, again, I think the tools that they provide is the stories, it's the history, it's the social interaction. I'll give you one example, and I'll put my business hat back on. When we're doing construction, we, of course, are borrowing money from a lender, and we have all kinds of, and equity partners, and we have all kinds of insurance that is placed on the building for risk, and it's called builder's risk insurance. And insurance is a good thing to have in case there's something terrible that happens, but it's also has a large premium, just as you do if you have your car broken into. And to have a building broken into time and time again where someone is either stealing copper or stealing tools or kids playing inside when they're not supposed to can cause many, many incidences of calling in your insurance. But when you have a community that's engaged in what you're doing, those eyes are on the street even though we may not be there in the middle of the night. Those eyes are on the street even though we may not be there on the weekend. The same principles that Jane Jacobs talks about matters to developers, matters to people who are trying to make positive change in a community, because they can ward off some of those folks who may want to have jumped over a fence and caused trouble inside a construction site. And that helps us. That helps us not only feel good about the work that we're doing because there's a sense of pride there, but it also, at the bottom line, it helps us in terms of, no kids are throwing rocks at your buildings.
Makes sense. You've developed a number of properties in D.C. near Howard University and the U Street corridor. Not too long ago, this was a really depressed neighborhood. What happened to turn it around?
I think there were some key elements of this neighborhood, Shaw. And as you know, many factors are usually involved in the turnaround of a neighborhood, but I'll name a few. One, Metro was brought into the area, and Washington, D.C. has one of the top Metro systems in the country. And it made people realize that we're only one or two stops from Central Business District, and that was important. It was also an historic assets that are in the neighborhood. DuPont Circle was already established neighborhood that had great housing stock that was a few blocks to the west. You had a great institution in Howard University that was bookended the other side of the neighborhood on the east. You had the Metro in the middle. You had a commitment of government to bring a government center and jobs during the day. You had great bus lines. And lastly, you had a tremendous amount of history in the neighborhood, and you had a commitment and leadership by the city to start investing in those assets like Lincoln Theater, like the Source Theater, like the Thurgood Marshall Center. And I think when you combine all of that together, plus the national pace of institutional capital coming into urban markets, low interest rates, you put all that in a big soup and you start to have a neighborhood come alive. What's important in that is that if you have market forces at play without some sort of guidance and with some sort of interference, then you can have full-on gentrification that has people displaced out of a neighborhood. And so we were able to not only strengthen the neighborhood with new housing, mixed-income housing, we were also able to do affordable housing in the neighborhood, and especially preservation of affordable housing of existing long-term residents. We had a project called the Capital Manor Cooperative where we assisted a 100-unit rental project to be transformed into an affordable cooperative, and it was able to save 75 families from displacement. In the midst of all the things that are happening on U Street and in the Shaw neighborhood is astonishing.
What would make it easier for national capital to invest in cities, and particularly in depressed inner-city neighborhoods?
Well, I think we cannot get around the historical notions of redlining. And if we can get around that through a variety of tools, CRA and other things, that's one level of convincing neighborhoods that it's convincing national capital partners that it's wise to invest in neighborhoods. Then I think it's very important to make the business case that there's density in a lot of these urban neighborhoods, and even though they may not the neighborhoods may not have high incomes, there's aggregate amounts of disposable income that matches even the best suburbs. And I think once you make the business case that there is income there, then you can make a retail case, especially when you look to preserve historic buildings. There's a case to replenish the housing stock, and if you have good urban transit on top of that, then you have a combination that for national capital providers, it is very important to mitigate risk. And when you have those layers together, you are mitigating risk. When it comes down to the last component of that, which is the developer, and a developer that can execute and use a competitive advantage in that neighborhood for us being able to honor the soul of the place, then you covered all the bases, and their investments will be sound investments in neighborhoods that hit a double bottom line, even a triple bottom line, in terms of being a sound business investment, a sound social investment, and hopefully a sustainable investment in these neighborhoods as well.
As a developer, what signs do you need to see in a transitioning neighborhood to give you confidence that the neighborhood's ready for you?
It is a couple of things. We look for leadership in the neighborhood. We start with the people. And that may start at the citywide level, at the mayor's level, but then you dive down and look for the leadership at the local level, at the neighborhood level, because without a strong leadership, then you have a tough time taking the blinders off and being able to imagine something grander. The second thing is we look for infrastructure. We are attracted to neighborhoods that have strong transit infrastructure. We're attracted to neighborhoods that may have a historic nature to them, and we're attracted to neighborhoods that have flexibility in zoning and other things that allow us to reimagine the canvas. We can get away from strip malls with large parking lots in the front, but then we can imagine 2, 3, 4, 5-story buildings, or even larger, to be able to accomplish a lot of the social goals that may be desired by the community, which may be a medical clinic, as I said earlier. It may be a retail library facility. It may be affordable housing. And using the real estate and the densities to be able to achieve all of those goals.
One of the challenges in transitioning neighborhoods is to attract the retail at street level. It's difficult to get the retail to match the ambitions for the neighborhood. How do you attract the right retail?
Retail is a very tough business, and we think it's very important to attract the right retail. I agree with you completely. But I also believe that as we look to attract retail, we have to put in place provisions that allow us to keep the retail that was there, if it is appropriate and is desired by the community. I think there's been a tremendous national discussion about gentrification as it pertains to housing. There's been very little discussion about gentrification as it pertains to retail. We look to provide provisions, and we're doing this on Inshaw now, to provide retail condominium ownership as a way to get local retailers to be able to fix their overhead as the community changes, where they were paying originally $25 a square foot and was able to survive because that represented 10 or 15% of their sales. 10 years later, when the neighborhood has changed dramatically and you have a lot of national retailers, they've driven the price up to 50, and the small local retailer can't compete anymore. So if we have retail ownership opportunities, especially for small businesses, they can fix their costs, and they can survive the transition and also be part of the prosperity at the end of the day when there's new residents in the neighborhood, new office workers in the neighborhood, and they can still be part of that at the end of the day.
Jair Lynch is principal with Jair Lynch Companies in Washington. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Do you consider yourself a pack rat? City View's commentator Walker Smith says there's a personal commitment that comes with collecting stuff.
Since high school, I have taken great pride in my music collection. Albums filled my dorm room and CDs have filled my house. Quality mattered most, but quantity has always been important too. I confess to taking satisfaction in people's astonishment when they would first see my walls filled with shelf after shelf of albums and CDs. But no more. Over the last several weeks, I have put all of my albums and CDs in the basement. I had a temperature and humidity control storeroom built there just for this purpose. and I move nearly all of my hundreds of books and old magazines there, too, as well as my collection of Grand Canyon books, maps, and memorabilia. All of the souvenirs and mementos that my wife and I have accumulated over the past 30-plus years have also been moved there, including several overflowing boxes of pictures. In short, anything that used to sit on a shelf or a coffee table has now been put away. It wasn't easy, though. It took hours and hours of carrying box after box down the basement steps. Even packing the boxes took hours, because if things aren't packed correctly, they could be damaged. All in all, it was an all-consuming chore that took time, effort, attention, planning, and money. The upshot of it is that I now see my stuff in a different light. In particular, when I look at all that stuff crammed into one room in the basement, I am stunned by the amount of stuff my wife and I had been living with. Our lives have been crowded between mountains of neatly shelved clutter. Albums and CDs unheard for decades. Books and magazines read once and never opened again. Photos that captured moments we have no occasion to revisit. Now my wife and I are looking around the house with a fresh appreciation of space and simplicity, wondering what furniture or collectibles or housewares are just taking up space. Things are a commitment. Stuff takes time and attention, if not to enjoy, then to maintain and store. The more stuff you get, the more time and attention it takes. Nothing is easy to own. It might be easy to buy, but owning it comes with duties and responsibilities. The more stuff you have, the bigger commitment you have to make to it, until one day you find that all of your time and attention is tied up with stuff. I suppose a life immersed in material things is not all bad, but surely there are better ways to spend a weekend than relocating stuff to the basement just to reclaim some breathing room. And if it isn't relocating all that stuff, then it's preserving it, cleaning it, organizing it, and getting around in the middle of it. It's easy for things to take over. And that's why my wife and I have decided to put our stuff in its place and free ourselves from the creeping tyranny of things. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.